Frank Mink is a former neo-Nazi gang leader. He now lives in Des Moines, advocating for diversity and tolerance. This hour, his thoughts on the violence in Charlottesville. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As a former violent skinhead with prison time to prove it, Frank Mink now makes a difference in young lives in the Des Moines area with an organization he founded called Harmony Through Hockey. We'll get his thoughts on the white supremacist movement and what should be done to counter such views. Then in the second half hour, I'll be joined live by University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld. We'll talk about the steep tuition increases he's proposed over the next few years. He'll also answer your questions. That's all coming up. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was 10 days ago that violence broke out in Charlottesville, Virginia, when white nationalists protesting against the planned removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee clashed with anti-racism demonstrators. One woman was killed when a suspected white nationalist drove his car into a crowd. The president's reaction to the events has drawn widespread anger from across the political spectrum. President Trump did not immediately condemn white nationalists, and he said there were, in his words, very fine people on both sides. Now, this prompted several chief executives to quit his business councils in protest. Joining me now with his view on what's happened in the past few days, Frank Mink. Mink became a skinhead at the age of 13. By 18, he was roaming the country as a skinhead leader, as a neo-Nazi recruiter with gangs that would beat people, well, indiscriminately. He was finally arrested and convicted of kidnapping and beating a member of a rival skinhead gang. These are instances in his life which he's described on this program before. While in prison, he befriended men he used to think he hated, men of different races. He eventually moved to Iowa. He now lives in Des Moines. He's become a noted speaker and author. He uses his experiences as a former neo-Nazi leader to address diversity, tolerance, and mutual understanding. He's the author of the autobiography of a recovering skinhead. He'll be speaking at Prairie Lights on September 8th. Also co-founder of Life After Hate. Also co-founder of Harmony Through Hockey. Frank Mink, welcome back to our program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So give us your reaction in broad terms to what happened in Charlottesville, the aftermath, the refocusing on the problem of white supremacists in our country.
Well, I think a lot of people are thinking that these groups have gotten bigger since Donald Trump's come into office, and that's kind of not really true. They actually got bigger in 2008 when Obama was elected. These groups gained momentum. They just didn't do anything with it because what they kept doing is they kept saying, Obama's going to come take our guns, and that's when we're going to revolt, and Obama's going to do this. And he never did anything to make them have to revolt, let's say. So they were kind of dormant for about 8 years. So then Trump comes along. He knows he's trying to win this election, and this is a fact that he knew that he had to tap back into that anger. He had to tap back into what made these groups grow, and so he did. And so you can't just wake up this anger and then just put it to sleep when you want and say, okay, well, thanks, guys. You got me elected. I'm good with that. These guys are now awoken, and now they've gathered momentum by these little things like these statues being taken down. I mean, these are treasonous statues to our country. We should all be able to stand up and say this. These are treasonous statues of people who wanted to continue keeping people on this planet as slaves for their financial well-being. And that's what these people want to fight a war over. And now you have people that come out and say, well, it's about states' rights, and that's why they fought that war. Yeah, states' rights own slaves. That's what they were fighting for. So now you have all these upheaval coming up because of this. And these guys, they're different than what they you would think of as these neo-Nazis. These are mostly college-age kids, and they're just angry. They're angry and they're full of fear. And,
right. Let's talk about the sort of the demographics as you see them here, because you grew up in the south side of Philadelphia. You became a skinhead. When you saw the faces and learned of the people who were protesting, the white nationalists, the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville and other places, as you keep sort of your finger on this pulse of neo-Nazis in the country, how do they differ from your background?
A lot of them are more highly educated and are in college right now, and a lot of them also still older men that are coming out. When we used to have more of a younger group with a couple older guys as leaders, these guys have more older men coming out and protesting with them as well.
So what are their goals at this time and the place, Charlottesville? But, I mean, it's evident now that they had been planning protests like these across the country and continue to do so.
Well, the next one's in San Francisco, and that's going to be a lot of trouble. San Francisco's a very liberal town, a very liberal city, and people are going to come out in droves to drive them out. And look, I've been talking about this on CNN and all the national news that have been interviewing me this week. When you go and you fight against these groups, I mean, throwing bottles, it really isn't. I mean, that's just entertaining your own self. I mean, you're not really doing anything to fight against racism by throwing a bottle at some redneck guy who's screaming, you know, the N-word. I get it. It's upsetting. It bothers me to my core. But when you have guys who show up and they just lock arms and they say, and they're all different races, and they just stand there and say, you're never going to break this. This is humanity. Because and that's what I've been saying all week, I've never ducked a bottle or a snowball when I used to march in these rallies or be part of the nationalist groups, and we would march and people would throw things at us. I never ducked a bottle once and thought, I better change my beliefs here because people are throwing things at me. I always thought, now I'm really into this. This is my, you know, this is my battle. So it kind of defeats the purpose, and I understand it's really hard for people not to get so angry and upset that they want to throw things at them and they want to punch them in the face. But are you really fighting racism by punching some redneck guy in the face who says the N-word? No. I mean, what you're doing is you're making him more racist than probably five other people who've seen it on the news. You really want to fight racism? You go and you protest the private prison industry. You go protest stop and frisk. You get behind, go to lobbyist firms who are already self-supporting these groups, and you go and surround their buildings and say, we're not going to take this anymore. That's fighting real racism. That's the real hard battle, not punching some redneck guy in the face.
If you've just joined us, Frank Mink is my guest this half hour, former skinhead leader, neo-Nazi recruiter. Now he's become a noted speaker and author. He uses his experiences to address diversity, tolerance, and mutual understanding. So you think at this point, even though it's really resurfaced in the last few days in a big way in our national consciousness, that we do have this element of neo-Nazis, white supremacists, you don't think it reflects a growth in the size of this group, what we are seeing right now in the media being reported?
I mean, I think the growth has already been there. This is just the head of the snake kind of popping out. You're still getting the guys that are behind websites and stuff that don't come all out, but they are starting to come more out of the woodwork, and as the snake will start to come more out as you lift it up. Mm-hmm. But again, these groups started to grow again in 2008. So that's when the swell started, the tapping into the anger. And I mean, that's when you join these groups, just like myself, I was a fearful, angry person. That's who joined. You don't join a neo-Nazi group unless you know there's something wrong. You don't have a happy, joyous life with your family and children and your parents or whatever, and then join one of these groups. There's something going on in there that you have issues with something, and you have fear and anger built up in you. That's what I said when I first joined this group. I could have joined any group at 13 or 14 years old. I could have joined a left-wing group. I could have joined anything. Anyone could have. I was a shooken up soda bottle, and I was just waiting for someone to take off the top and direct the spray where I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And these guys just happened to be the first guys to grab me, you know?
The thinking of these neo-Nazis when it's described to us is so alien to many of us, Frank. Help us understand. Put us in the shoes of that person, perhaps the marchers that we saw in Charlottesville. What part of being a neo-Nazi appealed to you most?
it gave me identity when I had no identity at all. I mean, my parents didn't give me an identity. My parents, you know, and my step-parents either were beating me or had no time at all for me. So these guys gave me an identity. And, well, what I want to remind people of, and this, it's going to be hard for anyone to really imagine this, but, okay, I would wake up in the morning, and my first thought would be, why do they have BET? Why don't we have white entertainment television? Now, again, I know facts and reason now where I could say all channels were white entertainment television, but all I thought about was how come they get black entertainment? And that would drive – those little things like that would drive my – drive me, and it would tie my stomach in the knots, and I would think about it all day long, and it would just make me more and more angry every day. Why do they get affirmative action? You know, I know affirmative action takes good jobs from white people, and again, facts and reasons now, I know the truth. Back then, I didn't, and these guys feel the same exact way. It's something that drives them every day. It's when they wake up and they look at this stuff, I'm sure they have either swastika flags hanging on their walls or they got whatever the new logo or symbol that they're using is hanging right on the wall, and you wake up and it's the first thing you think about. Why did they get this and why don't I get that? Why can't I be proud to be white and they get to proud to be black? If I say I'm proud to be white, I'm considered a racist, and this is what drives them all day long. Now, let's give the facts some reason. Facts are, you can be proud to be white. I know tons, and I know people in my family who came up in Irish American groups in Philly and Italian American groups. You could totally be proud of your heritage and be, because the difference between those type of groups and the white supremacist groups, who it's the bait and switch. See, racism and racist groups pull the greatest bait and switch. They tell you to come be proud of your heritage, but when you go join these groups, when you go to your meetings, you never talk about your heritage. You only talk about, look at the others. Look what the blacks are doing. Look what the Jews are doing. You only look at everyone else's heritage, not your own.
Uh-huh. So just to break in here, Frank, too. So yeah. You think that the talk about the statues is really just a disguise?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They don't really. Most of these guys that are part of these groups aren't even part of the South. They're not even from the South. These are Northerners who are just using it as an excuse. A great quote and a great question yesterday. A guy says, why are you carrying this Confederate flag? It's part of my heritage. This guy is from, like, Massachusetts, by the way. He goes, it's part of my heritage. He goes, well, what's up with the swastika? Because the guy had a swastika tattooed on him, too. So it's just a way to get it, you know. They don't really care about that because they know that in the long debate of all this, the South lost. They lost the war. They were treasonous to us. If the South would have won the war, our country would have been split in two. We would never have the power to beat the Nazis. That's how much history would go behind all of this, because we wouldn't have been a superpower. We wouldn't have had that many people. So this is their new fight. This is their little fight to have. And all these alt-right groups, it's just the neo-Nazis renamed. It's just the KKK renamed and rebranded. They know that they've been on the wrong side of history all throughout history, and this is like the new way of saying, we're not on the wrong side of history. Here's our new look, our new style, our new brand. But they're continuously going to be on the wrong side of history. And if we don't help stop this now in the right way, we're going to have another Oklahoma City bombing. We're going to have another, mass shooting. That's what comes out of these groups. And then when they do those things, then the groups go back under the woods because they know that they've been wrong. They preached anger, they preached mm-hmm. hatred, and they got enough people that they did something really, really bad. And that's the end result of all this, is a fireman running down the street with a dead little girl in his arms, like Oklahoma City. That's the end result. If we don't start doing something right here, and we're going to win. Humanity always wins this battle. We always will. It just matters how much damage can they do while their head is popped out of the woods.
Mm-hmm. So with this fringe group, and I don't know if you have an estimation of how many thousand of these neo-Nazis, white supremacists, the dangerous element here, are present in the United States. What is the overall long-term view? If you say there's going to be another Oklahoma City-style bombing, do they really envision a United States as led by white supremacists and neo-Nazis?
No, not the whole United States. Their end goal is to break off and have a homeland somewhere, and they're going to try it. That's what they're going to try this time. So it's just to say they're going to take up the northern peninsula of Michigan, something like that. That's what they want. And what they're going to do is, because, and this all goes back to Trump now, they all think that Obama let Black Lives Matter riot. This their thought process. So I know someone's screaming at the radio right now saying, that's not what, facts and reason, okay? Let's remember that. So they think that Obama allowed for Black Lives Matter and Ferguson and the anti-police movement to riot in cities. And so he turned a blind eye to that so that the they can do those things and then later on step in. Well, they think that Trump's going to do the same thing, but for them. So they're going to go down and they're going to take up some land, like at the border in Phoenix, in Arizona, and they're going to take up this land and tell you, no federal government's allowed out here. This is our land. And they're going to hold it for a little while, just like they just did in Oregon, guys. They just did this not too long ago in Oregon for a couple of weeks. And then they're going to take up some hills up in Michigan, and they're going to try and bait the federal government to come after them so they can start the race war. A race war isn't black versus white. The race war has always been planned as white versus the federal government. So that's what they want. And I think that Trump will turn a long enough blind eye that they can get situated enough that they can fight this war. And because they think that Obama allowed for Black Lives Matter to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. It's clear, Frank, since with social media growing to be a bigger part of our society, it's had a big role in letting these hate groups organize. What do you think has to happen here in terms of social media and the use of the Internet?
We cannot and we should not, and I know that, again, this is what people yelling at the right, we cannot or should not stop people from communicating the way they want to. And freedom of speech is so vital, because I know that people say, well, why can't we stop this group? Because 10 years from now, they're going to stop another group that's, you know, and we're going to keep, you just can't censor. We have to let them, and plus we have to let them vent in a way, because we have to understand where they're coming from. Because us going again and punching them in the face at a rally is never going to change them. But me sitting down and having a conversation and having enough ammunition to argue the point is because I understand where they're coming from, because I've read their writings, I watched their websites, is the key here. It's me going down and not saying, you're dumb, you're stupid for believing this stuff. I go and I say, I understand why you believe this stuff. I understand why you wrote this. So we have to let them vent what they're talking about. And we got to be able to treat them, and I notice we have to be able to treat them with empathy. We have to be able to treat them with respect in the end. We have to treat them like human beings, even if you don't think they treat others as human beings, because nothing is going to change if we don't do this.
Mm-hmm. It might be a good time, Frank, as we come to the end of this conversation, to talk a little bit about your activities as you address diversity, tolerance, mutual understanding in a number of ways. You're co-founder of Life After Hate, A Harmony Through Hockey. Tell us about the groups you're involved with and the actions you're taking.
You know, I've really centered myself now more towards the hockey side of it. I'm more of a hockey coach. In fact, a lot of people notice, but the teams I've coached out of Iowa now have won like 6 national championships now. So we have a pretty good hockey program going here. And you know, what I try to do is every year I go to a couple people and I say, hey, can you sponsor a couple kids that won't never play this game? And usually that's black kids, Latino kids, kids who have never played hockey because it's just not in their neighborhood. It's just not part of their culture in a way. So when I go and every year I find a couple kids and I just introduce them into hockey. And then I make sure that they're, you know, that me and another guy that coaches them, and we make sure we teach them what a team aspect is, because hockey is such a team sport. And we just drill that home to them, like, you're part of the team, and you can't go out and just commit penalties, because then you leave your team. And it's all about just the team aspect of it, and that it doesn't matter what color the person is on the inside. It just matters they have the same color jersey on the outside. And so that's been my big thing. Other things that I'm working on is more media and books. I worked on a book with Jody Picoult that just came out called All Great Things, which has been on the New York Times bestseller list now for 20 weeks. And in fact, my story is in the book. Like, Jody, who is a very famous writer, wrote My Sister's Keeper. Mm-hmm. She wrote my story into her story just to kind of pay homage to me for helping her with the studies and all the work that I've done. So it's and that's about to become a movie. Julia Roberts just bought the rights to that, and she's going to play the main character. So there's a lot of that type of stuff going on, but that's not on the ground type stuff. On the ground stuff is the hockey and just reaching out to other formers and people that are getting out of this movement, and just kids that are racist. I've been doing a lot of interventions on kids where they're drawing swastikas on their books, so their parents ask me to come in and talk to them, and I go and I do intervention stuff with them around Des Moines.
So. Yeah, talk a little bit about it. An intervention you might remember from the Des Moines area. What happens? How does an intervention start, and how do you intervene?
Okay, you know, there's a one of my favorite ones of all times happened here in Des Moines. So a parent got a hold of me. Said her child is writing swastikas on his books at school, kind of drawing the Confederate flag on things, getting in a little bit of trouble because of it. So she took him out of school one day. She went to the school, said, I'm taking him out of school because I want him to go with this guy. And the school said, please, thank you. And so I took him out. And what I did was, first I took him to this really cool tattoo shop. Now, that sounds kind of weird, but I took this kid to a tattoo shop because when you go to this really cool tattoo shop, which is kind of famous place here in Des Moines, they have like all these artworks on their wall. And then when you open up some of their books, it has swastikas in it because most tattoo shops that comes along with these booklets that they have. Well, over every one of them, they had tape and it said, sorry, we're out of stock. Like you couldn't, they won't put them on you. They refuse to put anything racist on you. And as we're sitting there, there's this professional BMX biker in there who this kid, now this, what a coincidence. This kid admires this guy because he's a professional BMX biker. I didn't even know he was going to be there. Here, this kid starts talking about how, you know, anyone they ever see on the BMX tour, if they have swastikas on their bike, they ride, they try to push them up the road, you know. And so we're all just talking about it. Then I brought him to a rabbi who is a gamer because he's a big, this kid was a big gamer. So I brought him to this rabbi who is a gamer, and those two start talking gamer stuff for about 20 minutes, just having a blast. And then in the middle of all that, I stopped them both and said, so, Rabbi, if I show you the swastika, what does it mean to you? And this, to see this look of horror. And I said, well, this is the kind of the problem I've been having with him. He's drawing the swastikas. And then they had this talk. So now they already connected as humans, and now he sees that he's hurting this man. So then I brought him to another synagogue here in town who these this older couple who were survivors of the Holocaust come. And they love this kid. They're talking about how he looks just like their grandson. And as they're talking, he's like laughing with them. And I said, sir, if you see a swastika right now, what's that remind you of? We're in front of this kid. And this guy starts to cry. And he starts to say, it took everything from me. It took my mother. It took my father. It took all of our money. It took all of our homes and properties. It took everything we had. And I'm the last one left. And then his wife, who's also a Holocaust survivor, starts to tell her story about what that symbol did to her and what that symbol means to her. And he started to shake. The old man started to shake. He got so angry, and he started to cry. That this kid, and I'm starting to cry right now, this kid to see the effect it had on people. And later on, I dropped him off at his house, and his mom, that's me, and the next day she gives me a call, and I say, well, what, she said, he said, I'll never draw a swastika again. He said, that's a guarantee. I said, well, what affected him the most? And he said it was the old couple, the last couple he met. And I thought it was going to be more the biker guy, you know, because it was more of he's into.
Right.
But it was that guy, it was the older couple who did it. Wow. And to this day, the kid's a great, great, great kid.
What an intervention. What a story. And we don't have to see, this makes your work all worth it, doesn't it, Frank?
I mean, what? And that's what I mean. It's like, now imagine if you do 20 of them over the last, you know, 10 years or whatever it might be. It's just, you know, and almost, look, I pretty much prepare myself for these interventions when I do them. I'm not just a throw it at a wind type guy. When I have to do these interventions, I make sure I have all my ammunition, you know. And it's just like, see, this is what we have. Like, I just did Fox News the other day, and they tried to set me up. Like, they had a chance to really talk about stuff, and they tried to set me up so that I would go against the anti-fascist groups. And I was like, no, I'm not going. You know, like, on the air, you see where I'm just like, I give up. I'm like, never mind. Like, I'm done with this interview. There's so many people that just want to waste our time and just, you know, this stuff is just good for them. To me, when I see this stuff, I don't think, oh, yes, now people are going to be calling me. I'd rather just not call me. I'd rather just coach hockey. I really would. I'd rather just coach hockey because it's what I'm really good at. But what I want to say was, when I was in this group, and this is what you get with pundits, same thing with like a Sean Hannity type, they don't read an article in the newspaper for information. They read it for ammunition for an argument to go against the left or go against the right. And that's what we, you know, I still can go back to that person and be able to read something and just get ammunition out of it. But I also could read stuff today for just to learn.
Okay.
Because when I just learn, I become a human being.
Frank, it's been so good to touch bases with you again. We've run out of time, but thank you so much for sharing your most recent thoughts considering the national debate we're having. Frank Mink, former skinhead leader, Nazi recruiter, now he does all kinds of good work. You've been hearing about it. Author, he addresses diversity, tolerance, understanding, and it sounds like his pride and joy is being a hockey coach and making a real difference in young people's lives. Thanks for being a part of this show and for being a part of our community here in Iowa, Frank.
You got it. Thank you so much.
Coming up in a few minutes, I'll be joined live in the studio by University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld. You can join our discussion with your questions, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as students head back to campus for the fall semester, perhaps you have a student who's headed back to campus, or perhaps you are a student who's found himself or herself back on campus. Well, we like to check in with Iowa's university and college presidents about this time of year to discuss the challenges they're facing. Joining us this half hour in our Iowa City studio, Bruce Harreld, president of the University of Iowa. He's been in that position coming up on 2 years. President Harreld, welcome back to our program.
Ben, good to be with you.
I want to welcome our listeners. Your questions for University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld. We'll talk a little bit later about a University of Iowa tuition proposal that would increase resident undergrad rates about 7% each year through 2022. What questions does that raise for you in terms of college affordability? Join us with your questions for University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us river2river@iowapublicradio.org. President Harreld, a few days ago, you welcomed back the over 33,000 students, I think, at the University of Iowa, and in doing so also denounced the KKK, the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists in the wake of the violence we saw in Charlottesville, the injuries, the one death 10 days ago, I think. Prompts me to ask you, where do you see the limits of free speech on your campus?
Well, I think there's a distinction in our minds, an important distinction between free speech and academic freedom, both of which we support completely. So this was not, in my mind, an issue of free speech. You're allowed to come to our campus. We're an open community. Express your point of views. On the other hand, you cannot bring hatred and violence to our campus. And so I was trying to remind our community and others that there's a difference here. We are a very accepting community, all sorts of points of views on our campus. In fact, we bring different points of views into our classroom as teaching points. And at the same time, we don't bring hatred. We bring inclusion. We're not divisive people. We're uniters. And part of our culture is celebrating a vast array of differences in thoughts and abilities of expressing those and debating those. Good Lord, we have violent debates on so many issues on our campus. But at the same time, it's civil, and it never gets into personal hatred or group hatred or violence. And that was the distinction I'm trying to draw. You have the right to speak your mind here. You don't have the right to actually make our campus unsafe.
So making it unsafe in terms of coming with weapons or potential weapons. Well, how do you define, coming to make something unsafe, a situation?
Well, in particular, when people start pressing their bodies against one another and trying to take my space and starting to bring weapons, to bring sticks, to bring shields, and exert physical power. So we're very supportive of mental power, and we have a lot of interchanges where we're all expressing our mental power, if you will. But the minute it starts to become physical, I think we start drawing some lines. And I was just trying to and I hope people took it. I got a number, probably the most positive support comments as I've walked around campus, as well as an email and even some physical mail responses to this than anything else I've ever said. And I haven't gotten a negative yet. I'm sure there's someone out there, and maybe now that I've said that, the people on the other side will express themselves. But it was interesting because and it wasn't intended at all to be at all the way into the political issue. It was just, what are the institution's values, which I think leaders have an obligation of expressing and reminding the community of, and at the same time, living up to those values. And so I was trying to basically said, particularly with almost in total now about 5,500 or so new members of our community, trying to make sure they understood who we are and what we stand for.
Did the violence in Charlottesville prompt you in any way to have any discussions or review protest policies on campus, or perhaps talk with the city officials in Iowa City, do sort of a what if? Are we sure we have the right policies in place? Should something like this be planned for the Iowa City area?
Charlottesville per se, a little. I think it's been going on all the way back to the election, and so I think we started really going through what you just described back in the election. And even before that, we actually went back to our original policies in the late 60s and 70s and found some of those and said, how much of those do still apply? And we had to update some of those, obviously. But I really think it started around the election. Then it actually got more intense around the early administrative executive orders that were coming down, particularly the travel ban. And then we had a group of people, and the Dreamers Act was challenged in various ways. And so there was – all of a sudden, our students are now living in a different environment where they thought they were completely accepted by our society. There were some statements coming out, and they were questioning how accepted they were. And there were some protests. But so we had to ask ourselves, if it turns the other way and becomes more unruly and actually uncivilized and actually violent, what would happen? So we did interface with the state as well as the city and our own police department. But fortunately, none of that has happened. We've had some very peaceful protests where states of mind have been exchanged quite interestingly. And in many cases, I've actually joined in some of those just to listen and participate. That's part of the process.
By coincidence, President Harold, you and I were last night at a welcoming party at for the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. The residency is beginning this year. 35 writers from 34 different countries spending 12 weeks in Iowa pursuing their writing and getting to know Iowans and Iowa and so forth and each other. For the first year, just to pick up on your comments, I was surprised in talking with many of the writers, actually interviewing many of them, that many have not been to the United States, let alone to Iowa. They were actually, for the first time I can remember in over 15 years of talking with such writers, filled with anxiety coming to the United States because of the climate that we have here. Did you find that as well?
Yes, I think sometimes we forget. We view ourselves as living in a cocoon, but it's actually a pretty interconnected world. They are watching. I think across the United States, there's been fairly dramatic. I was at a drop-off in the applications of international students to a number of institutions. I was at an AAU meeting in spring. I believe it was in April. And we were all, the 62 institutions represented at the table, we were all talking about fairly dramatic drop-offs in applications. And I think it was directly related at that point in time to the travel ban. And then you pile other issues on. So, I think we – I don't want to say you were completely entitled to be surprised last night about that being forefront. On the other hand, I'm not as surprised. It's been going on for a while. We've been building up to it.
Mm-hmm. How have you reacted as president of the University of Iowa to this new climate that we are then showing to the world, to international students, for instance? What problems has that posed, and how have you reacted?
Well, we tried to do several things. I think one thing is we try to, as we did last week, when there's an issue pop up, we try to be quite clear about what our values are and where we stand on these issues. And so one of them is just taking a stand and reiterating that. But I think more importantly is actually doing something about it. So actually spending time, as we were last night, talking to some of the new international writers, students, they're not really students, but fellows that are in the program, talking to them about their concerns and letting them know what we're doing specifically. Tonight, there is a set of activities in a number of our cultural houses. So being visible, listening, and then enacting programs. In many cases, they're just individual students that need help. And part of our job is to help them here, particularly with the international students. I'm reminded of last year when the travel ban originally went into effect. We made very clear statements about the university policy. But we also asked an interesting question, which is how many students are from those seven original countries. And it turned out to be 86. And I remember someone saying, well, 86 we could get in one room and have meaningful conversations about what they need in terms of support. And probably need advice about should they take a job outside of the United States.
And you did this.
And we absolutely did that. We met over 2 days. It was a Friday and then a Monday. And many of the 86 had specific issues. They had job opportunities during the summer in another country. And because they were from one of the seven countries, they may not have been able to come back in the United States. And so we had said, whoa, well, we can help you because you probably shouldn't take that summer job. But let's find you another summer job here in Iowa City, which then led to housing issues and all the rest. But I think we have a tendency to talk and not follow up the talk with specific action. And we've been trying to work on both ends of that.
And a number of issues to get to, and I see our time is slipping away from us. Bruce Harold is with us, the president of the University of Iowa. Join our conversation with your question, 1-866-780-9100. Want to talk about tuition. Last week, you proposed hiking resident undergraduate tuition significantly at the University of Iowa in the coming years, 41% over the next 5 years. That's 7%, about 7% each year through the year 2022, raising rates from what they are right now to about 7,500 to, at the end of that five-year period, 10,500. Why such a steep increase?
Well, let me back up. Bear with me for a moment, because I think it's the – we have had a decade of dropping in performance in a number of key areas, most importantly around student success metrics. We are asked to benchmark by our regents against a number of other Big Ten schools, plus Arizona, UCLA, Texas, and North Carolina. And if you look at their student success metrics, and I'll just give you a couple of examples, that group, first of all, U.S. News and World Report, on average, taking ourselves out of that, they're at 19. We're at 33. In terms of the graduation rates, they're at 93%. Retention rates, and ours are at 86%. In terms of the four-year getting out within 4 years, we're at 51%. They're at 63%. There have been a decade of a decreased funding. We're one of only 11 states in the United States where let me back up. 100% of the states have had deappropriation by their state legislatures. We're only one of 11 states that haven't been able to take the tuition up to recover that. We're actually fifth in the bottom. After a decade, I think you're beginning to see the outcomes in our rankings, AAU rankings, U.S. News Report, some of the numbers I just cited. And we have worked for the last year and a half very hard in trying to take a close look at where we want to be. And do we want to be in that pack and in that club? And if so, we have to up our game. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, I say this is more than about tuition. It's about a choice. The choice is, what type of institution should the University of Iowa be? Is it a world-class member of the AAU, one of those 62 elite institutions in the United States and in the world? Or are we comfortable dropping down into the lower rankings of that and maybe even dropping out of that?
Okay, you could ask another question. Are you an institution that, as a public university, is still affordable to every student who is merited to come through these doors? The affordability at $10,500 a year is a question for many students and many families supporting those students.
Indeed, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but we're at the bottom of the index. Our tuition rates, we're a bargain. In fact, for year in, year out, we've been one of the better values in a number of rankings. Our tuition is at the bottom.
And with this increase over the next 5 years, we'll remain at the bottom?
With this increase, we would actually be at the middle of the peer group today. So that's assuming no one else ever takes their tuition up over the next 5 years. At the end of 5 years, we would be at today's median. But I want to come back to a bigger point, which is, this isn't about the tuition. Well, let me look at this another way. We need to get to do what we think we need to do to deliver student success and outcomes, and to protect the brand of the that's going on the CV of our students as they go out into the job market. We need about $33, $34 million a year. 35% of that, $11 to $12 million, we're going to take from internal cost efficiencies, restructuring our own activities. Stop doing some things to put it right back up against the issues that we're talking about. And then we're asking the other 65% to come from the state or tuition. The numbers you're referring to assume that the state gives us no more support. The last year they took us from $232 million in total support to $216. We're assuming in the 7% that they don't take the $216 up.
So this is also a message for our legislature.
Big time. So, and we're agnostic. If in fact the legislature can find a way to support us more, then the 7% would come down concomitantly, proportionately. Mm. And I think that's the dynamic. This isn't just about tuition. It's first and foremost about the choice. What type of institution should the University of Iowa make? Do Iowans want to have a world-class institution in their state? And secondly, how do we fund it? And it needs to be some combination of our doing, cleaning up our own act and becoming more efficient, and secondly, the state support, and finally tuition.
University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld with us for a final few minutes. We do want to include a call or two here for sure. Matt is with us in Cedar Rapids. Matt, you wanted to hone in on tuition as well, what the president has just been discussing. What's your question?
Yeah, I guess I'm just not clear. The way you just described things, I'm not hearing how raising tuition to the rates of the other universities you mentioned is actually going to improve Iowa's standing. I mean, this is still a top-tier school, Mr. Harreld, and nothing you said actually supports that performance is somehow going to look better while raising the tuition for students.
Okay, Matt, thanks. I guess please connect some dots here for us, University President.
Yes, and of course, just raising tuition or increasing resources, Matt's correct. One needs to go further than that. It's how you use the money. And if, in fact, we use the money and squander it away in some other activities, then, in fact, we'll stay where we are in terms of these numbers. On the other hand, if we put more programs in place for mentoring our students, what we call high-impact practices, getting them engaged in research, getting them engaged in the class activities that they're in, our cultural houses, the Living Learning Centers, we have so many different examples of how we tend to think about our university like ours is only in the classroom. It's actually 60% of the time students are actually engaged in other activities throughout our communities. The more purposeful we are in engaging those out-of-class activities to their in-class activities, the better off we are. So Matt's right. If we just take the money, put it in the pocket, and hire more administrators, it wouldn't be very effective. North Carolina is a very interesting example. It's a state where that has at the bottom of our peer group in terms of household income. Iowa's at the number three in the state. And if you look at North Carolina, they get from their state several hundred million dollars more in total resources, and their outcomes are better because they've chosen to invest them in the student programs to support academic tutoring, mentoring, counseling, leadership development, and the list goes on and on. And we're putting things together right now with the shoestring, and I think you can see it in the data.
Okay. Less than 5 minutes with University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld. Let's go back to the phones. John in Des Moines, welcome to the program. I ask you to be brief with your question.
Thanks, President Harreld. I appreciate your creativity and some of the sacred cows you've addressed here in Iowa.
Thank you.
All right.
My question is, and to the previous caller, I think the what indication of the value of the University of Iowa education is the amount that out-of-state students pay. So, I would use that as a metric. But my question, in terms of diversifying some of the revenue sources to the university, one that has been raised in the past, and I understand, the sacred nature of football and you want to be competitive, but there's a lot of money coming in through those TV contracts, and there seems to be a lot of money sloshing around in the athletic department and people looking for ways to spend all that money. And I'm wondering, maybe there's a way to work with the other universities so that more of this money can flow, back into the general funds from these universities, and we raise the brand of the entire university versus spending lots of money on a very narrow segment of this.
Okay, Matt, I think we've got it. Thanks from Cedar Rapids. Bruce Harreld.
You're absolutely right. We spent the most of last summer going line by line through every pocket of the university, not just the educational portion of that. And to your point about athletics, I won't speak to other institutions, but within our own institution, we actually have started a program with athletics, and they give us several million dollars a year already. I should back up because there are just a small group of Division I athletic departments that actually aren't running negative numbers. We're fortunate to be part of the Big Ten, and under good leadership, we actually are positive. And so last year, the athletic department contributed about $2 million to what we were just talking about, and that number we have a plan to continue taking that up and particularly support the cultural houses and some of the mentoring and tutoring and campus safety issues I was alluding to a moment ago. So you're absolutely right, and stay tuned. We'll be doing more and more of that.
We've got a couple minutes left before we have to end this conversation. Let me ask you, because you are a former corporate executive with IBM, Kraft Foods, Kraft General Foods, Boston Market. In the nearly 2 years you've been here, you mentioned restructuring a few minutes ago. What have you done in terms of bringing practices from the corporate world to make the UI more successful? Can you give us any concrete examples?
Well, I think there's a lot. I think we've changed the budgeting process fairly substantially. In the way we've developed a new strategic plan, we've now shifted the way we allocate resources to get over those issues, hence some of the numbers I was talking about earlier. But I think more importantly, we've gone college by college to understand, and one of the points I was making last week in the tuition discussion is it's very – I have to be very careful comparing institutions. It's hard – Iowa State and Iowa love to be compared to one another, but they're very, very different. The economics of a medical school – versus a law school, versus a dental school, versus an engineering school, they have all have terribly different economics. And so we've now got – we can now understand the differences in each of our colleges. That's – so we're, it's more like a business unit P&L that we have, 11 of these. So that's one, resource allocation, as I said, is a second. I think also the cultural issues that we've tried to instantiate, living to our values.
Nearly 2 years as the University of Iowa president, do you think you understand the academic world in your position as an administrator as well as you understood the and do understand the corporate world? Are you up to speed now?
I don't think I'll ever be fully up to speed on any of this. I think we're always continually learning, and I leave the judgment of that to others. But I have a lot of people helping, and I feel quite comfortable in the academic as well as the, if you will, the budgeting world that we're living in.
Okay. Bruce Harreld, president of the University of Iowa, hope to continue this conversation with other university and college presidents here in Iowa. Thank you for your input. Listeners calling in, Bruce Harreld, president of the University of Iowa, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day tomorrow. Hope you'll join us. Until then, goodbye.